Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to CAF Chats. I'm Major Rhianne Wentz, and today we are discussing United States versus Kigo, and we'll be talking about the confusing world of implied bias of panel members. But before we jump in, I am joined by
Major Alex Altimus
and
Major Corey Squires.
Alex, welcome.
Thank you.
Crimlaw, where did you come from?
I came from Fort Carson, and I was the special trial counsel there for the last 3 years.
Okay, so you've dealt with some panel cases, maybe?
A few.
Okay. All right, so let's jump right in, and we'll start by talking about the facts. Alex, what are we dealing with here?
So this case was originally heard in 2020, and because of COVID guidelines at the time, the military judge did not allow group voir dire. Potential panel members completed a standard questionnaire and then a supplemental questionnaire. The military judge conducted in-person voir dire of individual members with trial and defense counsel present. After voir dire, the defense challenged 14 of the members for actual and implied bias. The military judge granted 6 and denied 8. At the MMCCA, appellant argued that the military judge committed error in denying appellant's challenges against 4 of the 8 members. The NMCCA disagreed. CAF then granted review to determine whether the MJ erred in denying actual and implied bias challenges against 3 of the panel members. The appellant, Kigo, argued that the military judge committed error in denying both actual and implied bias against 3 of the 8 panel members. CAF referred to those 3 members as Lieutenant Commander Charlie, Lieutenant Commander Mike, and Lieutenant Sierra. Let's talk about what appellant raised about each of these members. First, for Lieutenant Commander Charlie, at trial, defense challenged him on multiple grounds, asserting his statements and background experience with sexual assault demonstrated both actual and implied bias. Appellant pointed to 3 points of issue with Lieutenant Commander Charlie's answers on both his questionnaires and in-person individual voir dire. First, his statements on presumption of innocence and the accused's right to remain silent. Second, during his service as a fleet member for the Naval Academy's Sexual Assault Prevention Response Program and the comments he made about the problem of sexual assault in the military. And third, that his mother was the victim of a kidnapping and attempted rape a few decades earlier. During individual voir dire, Charlie stated that the fact that there are charges suggests that something happened. The fact that you get through charges in a proceeding like this means that it's not a simple he said, she said. Something has had to have happened. And then on his questionnaire stated, since we are at a court-martial, a flimsy or easily proven false accusation would have been dropped by now. Additionally, when questioned on the accused's right to remain silent, Charlie stated that he had a desire to hear the accused's testimony, that he should testify to prove his innocence, and that it would be self-defeating for him not to put on a case or provide evidence and witnesses that would corroborate his statement of innocence. While he stated he would not hold this silence against him, Charlie said it would come to his mind during deliberations. Second, for Lieutenant Commander Mike, the defense challenged her on the grounds that her statements about consent and victim credibility demonstrated both an actual and implied bias. For consent, she stated that she believed consent for sex must be clear and unequivocal, and that she could not imagine a sexual encounter where one party honestly believed there was consent, but the other party did not consent. For victim credibility, appellant argues that Lieutenant Commander Mike's statement suggested she would be biased in favor of the prosecution. Specifically, when Lieutenant Commander Mike stated, we should err on the side of believing rather than on the side of disbelieving alleged sex assault victims, and that as a panel member, she should believe over disbelieve someone who makes a claim of sexual assault. Of note, the government offered no argument in opposition to defense's initial challenge of Lieutenant Commander Mike.
And Alex, so you said that government didn't offer an opposition. So did the government join, or did they just say that we don't have any opposition to the challenge?
The government did not join. They just made no comment to the defense's challenge.
Yeah, I think they said no argument or something like that.
Yeah. And so do we think that there's a distinction there?
I do think. I think that if they had joined, it would have been both parties agreeing, which would have put the judge in a different position than just stating they have no argument to provide. And then third and the final panel member was Lieutenant Sierra. The appellant challenged Lieutenant Sierra for actual and implied bias based on his wife being a victim of sexual assault and his negative views about sexual assault. Specifically, Lieutenant Sierra stated that he has always found sex crimes to be distasteful and cringeworthy, but learning of his wife's rape strengthened those feelings and made them more personal. CAF held, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying all of the appellant's challenges for actual bias. However, CAF found that the voir dire responses of two of the three members, specifically Lieutenant Commander Mike and Lieutenant Commander Charlie, presented closed cases for implied bias. And because of the liberal grant mandate, the military judge committed error by denying those two challenges.
So now we're going to kind of talk about how CAF actually analyzed this case, and we'll throw it over to Corey for that. But essentially, CAF is looking at these three panel members and their answers and analyzing whether or not there was actual bias and whether or not there was implied bias, because those two things, to remind our listeners, are two very different analyses. So, Corey, what do we have for analysis?
As with any legal analysis, let's start with the text of the rule itself, which in this case is Rule for Court-Martial 912, Foxtrot 1, November, which authorizes excusable panel members for cause when the service member should not sit as a member in the interest of having the court-martial free from substantial doubt as to the legality, fairness, and impartiality of the proceedings. And from this, challenges for cause for actual and implied bias flow. So actual bias is known bias in fact, and oftentimes you'll see courts dispose of it pretty simply by looking to whether the prospective member swore that they could set aside any opinions they might hold and decide the case on the evidence, and whether their protestations of impartiality should be believed. And in this case, the actual bias issue is disposed of fairly easily. The CAF devotes, I think, three sentences to the discussion of actual bias. And they find here that there's a deferential standard of review for trial judges who are assessing credibility during voir dire. And so here, the military judge cited the relevant actual bias case law, made express findings of fact that were not clearly erroneous, and recognized the liberal grant mandate and placed the reasoning on the record. The Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces affords great deference to military judges when they do this on their actual bias determinations. So they held pretty easily that the military judge did not abuse the discretion for denying the actual bias challenges. But the analysis does not end there because of the implied bias standard. So implied bias is bias attributed in law to the prospective juror or member, regardless of any actual bias or partiality. And the test for implied bias is whether there is a risk that the public would perceive that the accused receives something less than a court of fair, impartial members. Courts consider the totality of the circumstances when they decide this, and they assume that the hypothetical reasonable member of the public is familiar with the totality of the circumstances and the unique structure of the military justice system. So it's an objective test. It's partially based on findings of credibility, but it's not quite like actual bias. And one of the big differences is that the standard of review is different. So it's less deferential than an abuse of discretion, but more deferential than de novo review. And the, as we'll discuss later in the Kigo opinion, the degree of deference that the trial judge will receive can depend on the extent to which they put their analysis and findings in the record.
And Corey, it strikes me that the analysis that CAF gives us is 50% about implied bias and the facts of this particular case, and really 50% on the appropriate standard of review, because as you just articulated, it exists in this kind of gray area of both abuse of discretion and de novo review.
Right. And one of the criticisms of some of the voir dire case law, both for actual bias or implied bias, is that the standards can be, you know, too subjective or difficult to understand. For instance, the actual script from the military judge's bench book includes citation to the liberal grant mandate. And when the judge cites the liberal grant mandate on the record, they get increased deference on appeal. But a lot of times they're simply reading from the script, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they've accurately applied it. And what is the liberal grant mandate? Well, as this case kind of shows, it can be difficult on appeal to resolve issues of actual or implied bias. You know, the appellate courts look to the record to try to find information about the member's state of mind, and sometimes that's easier to do in other cases. So the liberal grant mandate recognizes that this is best handled at the trial level. It's easier to address potential member issues at the trial court, and much more difficult to do on appeal with a closed record. And then just the nuances of the military justice system, the fact that the convening authority that convenes the court is also the one that selects the members, you know, raises questions in close cases as to why those members were selected at all. So the liberal grant mandate was established by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, just directing trial judges to grant challenges for cause in close cases.
When you use the word direct, it's not an option for judges, right? So if they find that it is a close call, then the case law says that the military judge must. Is that right?
Right. It is not a liberal grant suggestion. It is a mandate. So let's take a look then at the implied bias standard of review that is given in this case. So we talked about kind of this sort of sliding scale somewhere between abuse of discretion and somewhere more deferential than de novo review. And what happened here, the court talks about the trial court's analysis on the record. And obviously the CAF found that the actual bias challenge analysis was sufficient. And they talk about how during the rulings on implied bias, the military trial judge started on pretty strong ground. So he recited the standard for implied bias, and he explicitly stated that he applied the liberal grant mandate when analyzing the challenges to the three members. But that was the extent of the reasoning. So unlike the thorough explanations for the trial judge's decision on actual bias, it was silent. The record was silent as to the reasoning for denying the implied bias challenge. And because of that, the trial judge did not get the kind of deference that would have been afforded to his rulings if he'd placed a more detailed analysis. So when we teach voir dire here at the Teach Aglets, one of the things that we talk to counsel about is to avoid questions that invite what we call a socially desirable response, or to avoid questions that have an obvious right answer is another way of putting that, because they don't necessarily provide helpful information for counsel to make the decision as to whether to use a challenge for cause or a peremptory challenge against the member. Because you ask, you know, for example, do you believe that the accused has a right to a fair trial? Every member is going to know that the expected answer is yes. And so the answer that you get probably isn't going to be very helpful for making the decision that you have to make as to challenge the member or not. And we see all too often with attempts to rehabilitate a member, the member has said something that is questionable or raises concerns as to whether they'll follow the court's instructions or whether they understand a legal standard or something like that. They've done something, said something that is questionable. And too often trial counsel get up and using leading questions say, can you put aside any of your feelings and listen to the military judge's instructions? And the member like says yes. So there are, you know, these leading questions that have an obvious correct answer that are seen as these kind of like talismanic magic words to fix the possible issue.
Well, and the thing that I've always struggled with is not only are they asking leading questions, but we consistently ask commanders to rely upon their legal advisors. And so there's a lawyer standing up there telling them, asking them leading questions, you know, can you do this? And of course, the commander's like, oh, yeah, absolutely, I can do that. Because they are picking up what the government counsel's putting down. And so that's one of the things I've always struggled with. Has the panel member sort of adequately put aside any potential bias?
What I thought was interesting in this, too, is there was no group voir dire. So I often find that there is a leader in that where hand goes up and all of them follow. I think it's interesting here. These are some responses, maybe it was in the supplemental or an individual, where they were much more honest than I've seen in a group voir dires. And so I think it's interesting that did we get more out of this panel because they were not in that group environment where there's a little bit of a group think happening with what the right correct answer is or what the person who's asking the question is really looking for.
That's a great point.
I think that too, and there was a supplemental members questionnaire here. So counsel went into individual voir dire, you know, with probably more information than they might have in the absence of that. And I also agree that you tend to get better information from panel members during individual voir dire, just because you can have a more complete discussion of the question and the answer and the members' feelings and thoughts.
Corey, I have gotten us completely off script. So we were talking about the analysis of CAF of these panel members. So let's get back to that. I apologize.
Well, you did kind of take us to what I think one of the takeaways from this opinion is. The court expressly states that a potential panel member's predictable answers to leading questions are not enough to rebut the possibility of bias, especially when some of those questions lead to more problematic answers. So one of the takeaways that I have for this case is when you rehabilitate a member, it's not simply asking, you know, the standard rehabilitation questions in a leading member that directs the answer to say, yes, I can put aside my thoughts, feelings, whatever the issue is, and follow the court's instructions. There needs to be genuine, credible rehabilitation that convincingly shows the trial judge, the appellate court, and anybody who's watching the proceedings that this member can sit on the panel without raising issues about the fairness of the proceedings itself. It's not simply a check-the-box list of rehabilitation questions. So I think one of the takeaways, as I would phrase it, is that rehabilitation, while it's possible, it needs to be meaningful, real efforts to show the lack of partiality for the member.
So I want to talk real quickly about the two panel members. I think it's Lieutenant Commander Charlie and Lieutenant Commander Mike that CAF ultimately found should have been removed from the panel because of implied bias. How did CAF go about analyzing that? Why did they say that those two should be removed?
Well, specifically what they say is that they conclude that the two challenge members presented a close case of implied bias. So it could, you know, arguably be less than a finding that a reasonable member of the public would have concerns. It was sufficient for CAF to find that these were close cases. So the liberal grant mandate would have applied here. For Lieutenant Commander Charlie, they find a reasonable member of the public might wonder how the accused could have received a fair trial when Lieutenant Commander Charlie appeared to be confused about the presumption of innocence and the right to remain silent. The government tried to counter with that, you know, the question and answer didn't occur in a vacuum, and Lieutenant Commander Charlie made other statements that kind of mitigate that position, but the conflicting statements weren't enough to convince the CAF that this was not a close case, in that they were not convinced that Lieutenant Commander Charlie convincingly demonstrated a departure from his initial views on the presumption of innocence and the right to remain silent. And again, part of that was the predictable answers to leading questions is not enough to rebut the possibility of bias. For Lieutenant Commander Mike, one of her answers related to the possible defense as to mistake of fact. And that's a pretty significant concern because the appellant actually raised a mistake of fact defense in this case. That was the same member, Lieutenant Commander Mike, that when the defense made their challenge for cause, the government offered no argument in opposition. And I have to wonder here now, with the benefit of the hindsight, in that a 25-year sentence and the convictions were set aside for this, if the government would have joined the challenge for cause or used their peremptory challenge to strike Lieutenant Commander Mike. And the government does get a peremptory challenge, and if they had used that in this case to strike Lieutenant Commander Mike, it would have eliminated any error on appeal. So that is one of the tools that trial counsel have to try to preserve the record, is to use the government's peremptory challenge not to help the accused or help the defense, but to ensure that the proceedings remain free from question about the partiality or impartiality of panel members.
So with both of them, because it rose to the level of a close call, then the liberal grant mandate was triggered and the court should have removed them. Now, do we walk away from this opinion with a different standard of review in implied bias?
Well, one of the court in some ways, I think, writes this opinion in a manner that is instructive for trial judges. And the discussion on page 373 of the opinion is particularly instructive. So the more clear the record is as to the trial court's reasoning, the more deference on their ruling they're going to get. So strong ground is where we started, by accurately stating the standard and expressly stating that they applied the liberal grant mandate. But it does require something more than that, some analysis of what the military judge observed that forms the basis for the finding that a reasonable member would not question the fairness of the proceedings. And so here in this case, we had a thorough explanation for the actual bias challenge, and you see the deferential standard of review for actual bias. The CAF very easily determines that it was not an abuse of discretion, but we don't have the same for the implied bias challenge, and greater deference for the military judge in this case would have been warranted had, you know, some of the reasoning been clear on the record. The tests for actual bias and implied bias are not the same, and the record is silent as to why, given the specific factors in this case, the balance tipped in favor of denying the challenge. So had that been present, the outcome could have possibly been different, but it's difficult to say. These were kind of significant issues, you know, that suggested, as the CAF stated, critical misunderstandings about fundamental constitutional rights. So I don't know if greater analysis would have changed the outcome here. I do think it's possible that when the court goes through the exercise of doing this analysis, maybe the trial ruling would have been different had that happened. But that again is speculation with the benefit of hindsight here. I do think footnote 5 of the Kigo opinion is pretty instructive for everyone. And I said earlier, it's not a liberal grant suggestion, it's a mandate. And footnote 5 talks about it, that some of the cases suggest, like, you know, a limit to the application of the liberal grant mandate. And CAF expressly notes that those cases are of little precedential value these days. And it is, in fact, a mandate that enjoins trial judges to grant closed cases.
Okay. And I think, Rian, to answer further, is while we don't have a new standard of review, I think the dissents are interesting in talking about how we need to pick one versus a sliding scale to make it easier for those trial judges on the ground to make these decisions in that environment.
Yeah, the dissents didn't really focus so much on the merits necessarily of the case, but more so a concern for the field and the military judges that have to apply this. And I thought it was really interesting in the dissent where they talked about, and this is Judge Maggs's dissent, to determine whether implied bias exists, a military judge must rely on nothing more than intuition to estimate the risk that the public will perceive that the accused received something less than a court of a fair, impartial members. So clearly both dissenters in this case are concerned about how should military judges go about applying this. But and we'll kind of talk, I think, more about this in the takeaways, but really it's about putting your rationale on the record. That's what's going to get the most deference from the appellate courts, I think. What do you guys think?
I agree.
I mean, I think it's hard to expect an appellate court to fairly review a silent record and say whether the trial judge is abusing their discretion because they denied to grant a challenge for implied bias when there's no explanation in the record as to why they denied it. Mm-hmm. So I understand that it can be difficult to apply the standard of the review. And I think there is a good argument that maybe it should just be a de novo standard of review. And that's what it really is. But the standard, or whatever you want to call it, exists, I think, to give some incentive to trial judges to put their reasoning on the record, which is not what happened here.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about takeaways. Corey, you already gave us one. Alex, what's your takeaway?
I think my takeaway is, for practitioners in these during voir dire, I would tell my counsel, don't win the battle to lose the war. I think the government here, in making no argument, if there is something concerning that a panel member is saying, I don't think there is anything wrong with joining that challenge. But I think what we've seen time and time again is that we can lose these cases in voir dire. So I think the liberal grant mandate, if it's a close call, if there is argument back and forth between counsel, I think the government's takeaway is to stop trying to save or rehab those people. As Corey said, them answering that they'll follow the law and listen to the judge isn't enough to take away everything they just said. So I think looking at the case more of, is this going to create a problem for me after, am I borrowing a conviction? So I think my takeaway would be for government to, when they're doing voir dire, to understand what implied bias, if this is a close call, and then the liberal grant mandate should, and if it doesn't come into play, that's something that we need to look at and maybe use your peremptory to try to save the panel as a fair panel.
Corey, what do you have?
I would agree with this. I think be wary of catastrophic success. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe, I don't know how large the veneer was and if there was a risk of busting quorum, or what benefit the government possibly obtained by fighting these challenges. But the trial counsel has an independent duty to protect the rights of the accused and the military justice system as a whole. And I think when questions like this come up that reveal critical misunderstandings about fundamental constitutional rights, the answer is not, you know, default, try to rehabilitate the member and fight the challenge. It's to ensure that the record is crystal clear what the member actually means, what the totality of the circumstances for their opinion are, and then, you know, make an intelligent decision on whether to challenge the member themselves to join the defense challenge or to use a peremptory challenge to excuse the member. Not every member is right for every panel, and that's okay. I think it's certainly, well, the outcome here is telling, right? This was a sexual assault conviction with three separate victims and a 25-year sentence, which is set aside because of...
implied bias?
Yes.
So I guess my take, I've never been a chief of justice, and I know that every chief of justice is going to cringe when they hear this, but I've just never understood this, we can't bust the panel, we can't bust the panel, we can't bust the panel. And again, I've never been a chief of justice. I've only ever been in the well. I've only ever been a litigator. And so I don't understand why that is part of the analysis ever. Because to both of your points, you're just borrowing a conviction to save yourself some short-term pain. And I've just never understood it. But
I think, though, the changes in the panel should hopefully prevent things like that, where this was 2020. Mm-hmm. So now with a bigger veneer, with more people coming in, busting the panel is not such a, because you have standbys already sitting there waiting. So hopefully that takes away that mentality that I do think a lot of chiefs of justice had, that we've got to sit a panel. Don't use your peremptory government. Don't bust.
That's a great point. Okay. Final thoughts. Corey, you have any?
Well, we do get the benefit of reviewing these with the benefit of hindsight.
We do.
So, you know, I don't want to be too hard on the trial practitioners, but I think that the takeaway here is important that not every member is right for every panel, and that's okay.
Yep. Alex, do you have anything?
I think if your judge is not putting explanations, I think it's fair to ask on both sides to explain what analysis they did to get that on the record to make sure that the appellate world has that.
Great point. It's been a pleasure doing this Cap Chats with both of you. Thank you all for listening. We appreciate it, and look out next time for our next episode. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.